Hariyadi Audiobooks presents Chapter 17, Peace is Facing Sorrow, from the book Cultivating Inner Peace by Dr. Paul Fleischman, as read by the author.
Part 6, Chapter 17, Peace is Facing Sorrow. If a reader were using this book as a practical guide to cultivating inner peace, he or she might now be thinking, I know that mere situational adjustments won't essentially improve my life, which gains its trajectory only from my own actions and feelings. I want to sail towards peace, easy in the currents of myself, harmoniously related to people and circumstances. And to achieve this, I have to consciously steer with peace as my pole star. When life storms and batters me, my goal is to return to course, and the will to do so creates the dynamic resilience I need. I'll limit myself to sail light and trim. I'll absorb the wise directions of those who've already negotiated these straits, soaked in the soothing words of peace, and my own words will add to the score. I'll befriend all I meet on wing and wave, an unwalled and welcoming life. But you might feel confused to find, having taken these steps, that you are oppressed by a cloud of sorrow. Yet this would be a good sign, because impersonal and surprising grief is the harbinger beyond the known world of yourself to the horizonless peace you seek, as the story of the Buddha will show. Siddhartha Gautama was said to have been born a prince in the lap of luxury. Handsome, intelligent, athletic, beloved by his parents and wife. This opening mythic image entices us because of our yearning for restoration of the complete security and love of childhood. In spite of that, the prince remained unhappy. Lush physical gratification simply isn't fulfilling. Against the demands of his beloved father, the king, who was guarantor of his son's worldly delights, against the plan of the castle and the kingdom, which represent the practical established order, the prince sneaked out of the palace of comfort, aided by his loyal charioteer, to find something more, beyond, deeper. Still cushioned within his royal chariot, the prince made forays around the capital city. The prince's castle of enfoldment was breached, and his sense of safety punctured, as he saw first an old man, then a sick man, then a corpse. His charioteer, the voice of fact, assured him that everyone will age, sicken, and die. The prince, at the sunset of his childhood under the protective parental roof, became distraught. He would suffer. He would die. There was no escape. His restless premonition had been objectified. Even if he were to remain a prince, bathed in boundless gratification from day to day, his life and pleasures would be ephemeral, and he would tumble on blindly towards pain, helplessness, and darkness. But on his fourth secret excursion into the city of the world, listening to his charioteer narrate the stark outline of existence, the prince, now primed to shed his childhood delusions, saw a spiritual seeker, a man of peace, calmly traversing the rutted, crowded lanes of worldly affairs. The image of the holy man is a symbol, of the prince's own aspirations, maturation, and incipient wisdom. This vision of a transcendent possibility catapulted the prince into a personal revolution. Like every young adult, he must and did flee the castle of false security and pleasurable distraction. Siddhartha Gautama abandoned comfort, his parents, even his beloved wife and infant son, because each person is essentially alone. No one can hide from fate behind others. The prince closed the door forever on his palace of ignorance. Siddhartha Gautama, no longer a prince, spent years in search, years of determined heroic hardship as a student of others, as a solitary hermit, as a fellow traveler of the hopeful and austere, in the wilderness of his inner world. When he emerged after 6 years as the Buddha, the fully enlightened one who is free from suffering, it was because he had plumbed suffering so consciously, staring into the cobra's eye. The core of the Buddha's enlightenment was his confrontation with the suffering intrinsic to existence. Everything born dies. Along with the birth of consciousness is the birth of suffering, because life is built over loss. Prince Siddhartha, like all of us, wanted to remain young and strong, sexual and safe, loved and happy forever. Every known form of happiness was guaranteed to evaporate at his death, yet he was unwilling to accept a merely pragmatic hedonism. He sought and found a way of life that connected his transient life to an ultimate truth within this one mortal lifetime. The bridge Buddha walked over, suffering, was the fourfold noble truth, the mastery of suffering, a psychological practice leading to liberation. All 84,000 sermons of the Buddha are built on the four noble truths. He said that the essence of Buddhahood, the absolute transcendence of suffering, is full mastery of just these four. The first truth is the realization that life is suffering, not that suffering might happen or can occur if one is unlucky, but that life by nature is transitory, filled with loss, and always terminated. The cause of suffering, which is the second truth, is that intrinsic to ignorant life is the craving for pleasure and fear of pain that are built into our animal organism. Since no life can consist of pure pleasure, even the mythic prince in his pleasure palace would eventually age, sicken, and die, craving and fear will always culminate in unwanted suffering. The third truth is radical optimism. The cycle can be reversed. A human being isn't a mere pleasure machine. Insight can prevail. Transformation can occur. The craving for pleasure and the fear of pain can be overthrown in favor of enduring values, timeless, selfless peace flowing past the universe. The fourth truth outlines the path by which the third truth can be actualized. The Eightfold Noble Path of virtuous living, insightful meditation, and liberating perspective that points beyond oneself towards Nibbana, pure peace. In the legend of the Buddha, he is born destined for liberation, but he still sought and suffered for 7 years. That time frame reminds us that we need to grow on the path with patience and work. When we read or hear claims of peacefulness based on a mechanical training of the brain or a facile philosophy of practice, we know these claims are inauthentic because we haven't heard about struggle. Conscious depth of suffering, your own problems and despair, are the Rosetta Stone messages by which you can decipher peace. Your personal truth comes to you as a wrestler. Peace is dynamic because it must answer the deepest human questions that you have, stirred by suffering and death as they manifest themselves around you and within you. A person may be busy, engaged, successful, even happy, but inner peace is a product not of what you accomplish, but of how you are. Inner peace is a skill in how to be. The spiritual dimension of life manifests itself as urgent questions, and peace must plumb as deeply as our dismay is rooted. Inner peace can be found only through confrontation with the potential bottomlessness that yawns when our life is seen in the perspective of cosmic time and certain death. Peace is discovered in a realm that is independent of conditions, an everlasting light. The more thoughtful and intelligent the person, the deeper their scrutiny of life and their despair. Despair is the lash that turns our ill ease into full-fledged knowledge of our plight and into resolute quest for a solution. The path of peace must lead through a cataclysmic realization of our future, because our forethought and cunning, which makes our species skillful predators, also precipitates abstract questioning, insight into death, and dismay about mundane time. Every hope is merely a fantasy of more life. No political platform or social action can ultimately solve our problem. What will happen to me when I die? Where will I be? How can I endure being nothing forever? I feel trapped. How can I get out of this horrible, total erasure? I have accomplished so little. The remainder is so brief. Historical memory endures only a handful of generations. My children, my family, my religion, my culture are themselves insubstantial, temporary. Our planet floats in a Milky Way of worlds. What is the point of my life? As people approach death through age, illness, or danger, the fairy tales that were formerly employed to bind anxiety into the background of daily life lose their persuasiveness. The comforting proximity of loved ones presages only separation and loss. Directly or fleetingly, as foreground or background, everyone knows what the Buddha found. Life is suffering. All children, all adults hear a whisper of terror in the night. How can any intelligent person be at peace? I know despair. I perceive the world as dead, empty, a machine. Bodies emerge from bodies. They consume bodies as food to grow themselves. Without observable origin or goal, the parade of flesh and form flows across time, and every form is temporary. A ghost that dies, disappears, loses everything. We ride a planetary rock in a repetitious orbit through an endless clockwork void. I think of ancient Egypt. For thousands of years, generation upon generation grew food, procreated, worshipped hawk-headed illusions, each one believing in a life after death, each one fantasizing some significance to this or that tiny twist of their personal fate, and thousands of years have passed, hundreds of generations, millions of lives, each imagining their daily concerns as overwhelmingly real. Yet not a footprint in the sand is left of each of those lives. I think of the Nazi death camps. Millions of bodies packed into heaps of ashes, year after year, an entire continent operating factories of death running full steam, vast stadia, cities, nations of people choked and burned, and each one in their personal agony totally unknown, gone, pointlessly feeling and suffering before the final anoxic agony of oblivion. Of those who died in comfort nursed by a daydream, and those who died in horror equally, nothing is left. Those who claim to never forget will also die, pass on, be long forgotten. Time swallows all life down a gullet of darkness. My death leads to nothing. I have no purpose. I'm trapped in a narrowing tunnel that ends in total black. Logically, life is hopeless. Beyond logic, I feel faith. It dwells in me separate from reason. Regardless of my despair, my heart doesn't stop, and faith beats with my ventricles. Before I ever thought about meaning, before I knew about science and religion, life parted in front of me in virginal flirtation. Pregnant import pervades every turn. Poems, gray-bearded men remembering ospreys, the upturned hand of a chanting singer, grasp me, redirect me with unaccountable fervor. The events in my days are syllables in a great aphorism, pieces in a puzzle I feel destined to complete. I feel aloft to my work that defies mere assessment of its measurable impact. Evanescent intuitions burst inside me like spices, and I taste thoughts that I never chose, which were born inside of me along with my brain. Particular patches of earth have drawn me around the planet to make my shoe prints in their dust. Words I heard one August dark, spoken from a perspective beyond historical time, flashed into my neurons and linger for years in an alpenglow of thought. My mind, Odyssean since boyhood, my heart, intractably re-hoping, were born to search beyond the known. Messages from past lives whisper goals, purposes, directions to me. Every obstacle is a semaphore. There are words I must write, meditations that must be followed in spite of any finality or absurdity. My deepest inner promptings infiltrate the impenetrable black and keep on traveling through it on wavelengths unknowable even to me who rides the beam. Faith is an inner experience, not ideation, belief, attestation. Faith is a felt experience of significance that is independent of time, life, death, and that shapes all future behavior. Faith isn't salvation or liberation, but the deeply felt, indelibly imprinted precondition for work on the path. It provides the hope and energy that enables spiritual life. It's not the prerogative of prophets and poets. On the contrary, it's commoner among unknown ordinary people whose self-esteem is not dependent upon achievement or recognition. Faith is an animated knowing that affirms felt salvation alongside the logic of meaninglessness. Faith doesn't cancel despair. It is lit by that subterranean pressure. As dark as is the inner night, that much phosphorescence must be pressed into existence within. The more you care, the deeper your despair, the brighter the light of your faith will be. I started this chapter by pointing out that if you had followed this book chapter by chapter so far, you would, by this time, have found not a soda fountain of joy, but the claret of sorrow, and I told the myth of the Buddha to clarify the role that direct immersion in sorrow has on the path to peace. The path from suffering to peace is a psychological truism, independent of religious ideology or of Buddhism. Anyone can experience growth in this direction. A modern Catholic American autobiography illustrates this point, providing us with a vivid example of someone initially trapped in a static ideology that prevented deeply felt despair or faith. The author's spiritual rebirth towards peace depended upon his discarding his old belief and experiencing enough doubt to kindle a truly kinetic faith. Jesuit Dan Berrigan has recounted in his autobiography, To Dwell in Peace, how he grew up with a religious ideation that was all he had to cling to in his childhood because the other pillars of life seemed rotten. He experienced his father as mercurial, threatening, mean. Their poverty was more than material penury, but a fearful, bitter state of mind. As a boy, Berrigan felt ethnically and religiously alienated from dominant American culture by his Irish Catholic roots. He experienced schooling as humiliation rather than education. Young Dan's adherence to traditional Catholic dogmas at least gave him a route to higher education, and by becoming an obedient Jesuit acolyte, he could study history, literature, and language. In spite of this vigorous and extensive education, however, Berrigan felt constricted. Life seemed burdensome. He felt imitative, regimented behind closed doors. Both horrific and final, I was a wooden Indian Jesuit. Eventually, doubts and questions erupted in him. His festering dismay was exploded by the deceit, hypocrisy, an anti-Christian spirit he perceived in the support that the Catholic establishment gave to the American government during the war in Vietnam. This shattered an elaborate realm of ritual and concrete belief nourished in childhood and amplified in decades of priestly education. Berrigan began to doubt his church, his elders, his beliefs. He slid down through serial depths of despair. The imperial Christ looming above, blazing there, ordering all things strongly and sweetly. He is shaken. What remains is impoverished, diminished, a mere breath on glass beyond all images. It was this elusive, pulsatile hint that turned his dreary cardboard life into a dynamo. Free of dogma, liberated from wrongful images he had coveted and concocted, yet in his own view remaining faithful to Christian spirit, he catapulted into leadership of the anti-Vietnam War movement. He became a daring, clowning, imprisoned priest of conscience and morality. His literary output mirrored his political somersaulting. He has written more than 35 books on politics, religion, social commentary, and poetry. The living, wavering, nameless breath of his faith was more generative and peaceful than his previously imposed certitude. His faith persisted not in the content of church dogma, but in an intangible softness, too elusive to fracture. He could feel the living breath of faith only when deep, honest doubt and historical forces coupled to explode institutionalized belief. Although Dan Berrigan witnessed other anti-war activist priests back off in fear of church or state, or leave the priesthood, as did his firebrand brother, Philip, he didn't feel disloyal. He didn't resign. He gave his undefinable faith back to society as his urgent anti-war outcry. Dan Berrigan's story reminds us that a life of peace is opposite from a life of compliant membership. Because peace rests on answers to unanswerable questions, it must dip down into felt faith that is invisible and impalpable. The reader of his biography wonders what about caustic gadfly Dan Berrigan is, after all, Catholic. His verbal excoriation of the church is unparalleled by any other continuously participating member. Somewhere in the mist of his breath on glass, he finds droplets of a continuously rejuvenating, formless faith and personal peace. Berrigan's experience also reminds us to beware of those who can account for their faith too exactly, like the robotic Jesuit that Berrigan claims he was as a young man. Those who have arrived at the breath of living faith cease to be imitators, repeaters of memorized formulas. They express themselves through right speech and authenticity of action. Father Berrigan added, "It gives me joy to report that I still seek out the mystery." His passage through sorrow and despair enabled him to emerge into the infectious delight that has characterized his public years. Gandhi said that God couldn't be seen, but came to him through action. Seeking inner peace brings you to the stage where your own inner life is like watching a solar eclipse. Direct looking will burn your eyes. You must follow the movement of a shadow. Inner peace isn't established upon the denial of despair, which would give despair the power of the underground enemy, nor in the attestations of faith, which would weaken faith with affectation. Faith isn't an answer, but a breath, a pulse, a shadow cast somewhere by an unbearably brilliant light. If you've seen it, that's not it. Your own thoughts, fantasies, conclusions can never guide you beyond your own thoughts, fantasies, and conclusions, which are all toys in the box of your brain. Inner peace speaks in two languages. Despair and faith are the language of the Christian and existentialist West. They describe the loss of individual-centered time and meaning to enable the discovery of peace-giving, felt truth. The Four Noble Truths are the language of the East. They describe a pathway beyond the personal ego because the ego is encased in the transitory history of one personality and is preoccupied with its own pleasure and pain. The Four Noble Truths activate a holistic enterprise of ego transcendence, enabling the realization of Nibbana, pure peace. These languages of East and West may differ only semantically. Even if they capture different experiences, they certainly contain homologous insight, sympathetic overlap. Both Buddha and Berrigan had to crack open the platitudes of their backgrounds and face the darkness. Sorrow is a canyon, and downriver from it are the expanded capacities of a more encompassing peace. Deep pools of turquoise equanimity.
Pariyatti, a non-profit 501c3 organization, offers a wide variety of books, e-books, videos, and audiobooks about the teachings of the Buddha, the Pali language, and Vipassana meditation. Browse our complete catalog at www.pariyatti.org. That's pariyatti.org.